listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And with me today is a music icon, Mr. Roger Daltrey, who was one of the co-founders of the musical group The Who. And Roger is with me today to talk about a charitable organization that he helped found and has been involved in now for many years that helps young people, particularly teens who are struggling with cancer. And Roger's going to talk with us about what inspired the creation of this organization and also how his music lays a foundation for change when it came out in the 60s during times of turbulence and what his music continues to mean to people today. Roger, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for including us on your good, better business list. That means a lot to me.
Well, it means a lot to us that you've gone through the process and your charity is accredited. And we want to talk about that, obviously, in this interview. I'm really interested, Roger, in understanding how someone who could have such a fulfilling career as a musician and artist, how that connects with you to the work you're doing with teen cancer. Where did this connection come from? I mean, you could very easily have just said, I'm not going to get involved in it. I'm a rock star. I'm not going to do this. But somehow you decided that it's really important to engage in this particular cause.
Well, this cause came out of 50 years of The Who being very conscious of their being part of society and about, you know, we came from the poorer side of life. We came out of a war. There was a blank canvas for us to paint on as far as, you know, we just got the windows and the roofs back on our houses from the Blitz. It was certainly not the throwaway society. So we realized what it was like to have very little. And when we made it successfully and started to earn money, we wanted to give back right from the very early days, right from the late 60s, early 70s. We were donating to charities that we thought had the potential of longevity, because there's a million charities out there and they're all to a certain extent worthwhile, but it's the ones which have a real mission that you can see longevity, that can improve the way society functions, that meant something to us. For instance, we, in 1973, were part of the foundation of a charity called Nordoff Robbins Music Therapy for Autistic Children. Now, then, this is 1973, you know, autism wasn't the known illness in youngsters or condition in youngsters as it is today. And again, we recognized this person who came to us and asked him for some help with musical instruments to teach autistic children to contact, you know, make contact in the real world. Music was bringing them out of them. And we just thought, this is brilliant. It's music doing a job that has got a social commitment. And autism, we knew at that time that it was a growing problem. Now it's obviously, you have to call it a pandemic now. So that was one of them. We recognized a thing we've got in Britain called a refuge, which was for women from, what would you call it, domestic abuse. In those days, it was all kinds of stuff. And that was a hard one, because it was a woman with a vision that she wanted to give refuges for women you've got to remember, London had a very big housing problem after the war, so there weren't enough houses to go around. Everybody, you know, you'd find in a normal house for one family, you'd often find three families. So housing was hard, but this woman recognised that because of the overcrowding in these situations, that domestic abuse was quite a serious problem. Plus the fact, I think our parents' generation were shell-shocked from the war. There was a lot of mental problems in families that we didn't recognise at the time, which we now recognise. So she just had a vision of just starting a refuge for women that were suffering domestic abuse. And we bought her a house, the first one that started this foundation. And that is still going today, which I'm, you know, really, again, we had the vision to see something that was going to be necessary and had a future. And then when the Teenage Cancer Trust came along, that was in 1990, and that was an idea that came from my GP doctor, my general practitioner, and his wife, Dr. Adrian Whiteson and Myrna Whiteson. They recognised that this was like I say, this in the 90s, beginning of the tech bubble, that teenagers were really, where they'd always been a bit different than either children or adults, the gap was widening. And they noticed the distress that teenagers with cancer were going through in our health system in this country, and indeed in your country, where hospitals, for convenience and a lot of, you know, old-fashioned thinking, are divided into two sections. There's paediatric and there's adult. Well, I'm afraid we have to say now that in today's world, there's a big chunk missing, and that is adolescent and young adult, because they are socially, mentally, physically completely different than either small children or older adults. But there was no provision for them, especially when they had cancer. And teenagers, you know, 16, 17, 18, up to 23 years old, up to 18 years old, were finding themselves sometimes next to tiny little children in hospital wards with some of the most vicious cancers. They're the most aggressive of all the cancers, and they are very rare. There's not an awful lot of numbers of teenagers that get it, but they're enough. I mean, it's high numbers. In England, we get 3,000 a year. I think in America, I think it's something like 60,000. It's enough.
Yeah.
So they recognised the distress that removing them from their peers was doing. And they said, well, let's just see if we can get a charity going where we'll work with the health systems. If they help us for this to happen, because it takes goodwill from the hospitals. You can't do it without goodwill.
Yeah.
And we'll build units for these teenagers and young adults can congregate and be around each other going through their illness. And I thought that's a really great idea. And what I really felt as well is that this is an idea that the music business should support, because the music business that has given me this life of incredible privilege. I mean, I can't tell you. The life I've had you could never have dreamt it. It's been wonderful. But it was all done with the support when we started, and indeed today, the whole music industry, the backbone of it comes from adolescents and young adults. Later on to be supported by, obviously, older geriatrics like me, but the main support of it, the drivers of that industry, is that age group. I thought this is the perfect fit. I'm going to devote my time to make this happen. And we've done it. In England, we've done it. This is 30 years. We're 30 years old now. We have 28 hospital wards, which we've built within our health service, which is a national health service, because it's like kind of government funded. It's a disastrous setup, to be honest. Nobody around the world has ever copied it. But we've made what we do in it work. We have these 28 hospitals up and down the country where anyone over the age of 13 under the age of 25, if they have cancer, they can be amongst their peers. They can make music and they can play pool and they can cook for themselves and they can... We try and make it as least like a hospital ward as possible. And with the results we've had from that, we haven't got it journalized. So I am kind of, I'm making statements now that medically you would have trouble supporting because medical journals, to get it journalized, is incredibly expensive and very difficult. But we do know, because we see the figures, we reckon we get probably around 10%, maybe just a bit more improvement on the conditions, because we can compare the results we're getting now, because the medicines in this age group, some of the treatments they go through haven't changed since the 70s, but we are seeing more success rate, and I think that's because they're mentally and socially happier.
Yeah,
really, it stands to reason that that's a proven given. You know, a mentally happy patient, and contented patient will have a far greater survival chance. So it works. We know it works, and I've done it over here. And I thought America needs this because your system's the same. You have children's hospitals and you have adult hospitals. I started to look. I went to hospitals all over your country. I went to CHOP in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Duke down in the Carolinas. I went to UCLA. And I visited hospitals and I saw you've got the most amazing, your medicine is way above what we've got in the UK. But I didn't see a closet that was suitable for an adolescent or a young adult.
Yeah.
You know, there was everything a child would ever want in the children's hospital. And there was adults were completely catered for with their lounges and all that kind of stuff. But there wasn't even a broom cupboard for adolescents and young adults. And I thought, this is wrong. You know, what century are we in now? And in my opinion, it is time. If I were Jeff Bezos or one of those guys with all that dosh, you know, I mean, I would certainly say, well, let's really put my name to something that really is going to matter and build the first wing of a hospital. You don't need a separate hospital, but a wing of a hospital that is designed just for that age group with any hospitalized illness. It feels socially right. It's socially the right thing to do. Because that age group now, they hold a lot of power now, that age group. And we can't ignore the fact that they're different. And we just have to listen to them. Yes, they talk a lot of rubbish sometimes, but yes, don't we? It will do not much difference, you know. I just think it will, I'm certain it will build a much better society, having those kind of facilities for them to bring them through into adult, full adult, much more secure in who they are and the knowledge that they're putting out there to the world on this thing we now have called the internet. Only love.
Well, this is wonderful. I am from Philadelphia originally, and I've seen and obviously spent time at CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and you're right. It is a fantastic facility. And it has everything a child needs to be at a place where they can recover from whatever ailments they're suffering. But you've hit on, I think, a demographic in our society whose needs may be somewhat ignored. And I want to commend you for that foresight to begin thinking about the needs of teens. And your point, too, that it was that demographic that sort of drives the music industry even today. So when we go to an award where you've set up, where you've established your organization, what are we likely to see? Take our listeners through a visual tour, if you would, of what they would see when they went in there.
Well, the last one I opened, which I really enjoyed, was down in Greenville, South Carolina, at Montsecure's. You go in, and it's a complete, we call them zones. You can only come into this zone if you're invited as a parent, and if you're of that age. So teenagers with cancer, as I said earlier, they suffer very rare cancers. They also suffer because of their age. They're growing so fast. The cancers tend to be more aggressive. They also suffer most out of all the age groups from very late diagnosis because they're so active. And a lot of the cancers they get are bone cancers, the urine sarcomas, those kind of things. And, of course, because they're playing football or you know, those kind of sports, the doctor will say, I'll come back in 6 weeks and I've hurt my leg. And we'll come back in 6 weeks and we'll have a look at it. And, of course, 6 weeks with a serious cancer like that is life or death sentence. Anyway, so you're coming to our zone and their rooms, in each individual's room, will be to the sides, but there'll be a big communal area in the middle where they can be together. It's like a, what can I say? The nurses are happier in their work because it creates an atmosphere of its own within the hospital. It becomes a happy place rather than a sad place, even though it's dealing with some of the most horrendous diseases you can do. When you see results of some of the treatments for cancer on some of the ones that they get, you know, it's frightening. But because the ward gets its own atmosphere, it's not doomy like some hospitals can be, as you know. So all I can say is that you can imagine a kind of, it's very hard to describe art.
No, you're lifting their spirits. I get a picture. I can see it's just the communal nature of it, it seems.
It's a commune, yeah. They're all there. They can all chill. They can have their boyfriends in and, you know, and the parents in England, the parents can stay overnight with their youngsters. The boyfriends sometimes stay when they're over the age. We try and make it as least like a hospital ward as we can. Obviously, it has to be supervised. But the nurses, like I said, it gains an atmosphere that makes it so much more beneficial to the healing process.
You know, we contribute to society, Roger, in many different ways. You've chosen to get involved in this Teen Cancer Challenge. But I would suspect you've also, through your music, been able to move society in a direction. Your music has legendary acclaim. And as you said, you've been able to live a life that is almost a dream. You know, everybody wants to be a rock star, and here you are. So how have you been able to, how could you say, for instance, that the music that you've created has moved society? You came along at a time of change in the 60s and maybe early 70s. What was it that your group was trying to do with its music in any way to shape society? Or was that even something you even thought about?
All we were hoping for in those days, obviously, was to make a living doing something we loved to do. And growing up in England in that period and discovering American music, especially the blues artists we had in America, was a goldmine to us. We understood that blues. We understood where that was coming from. You know, at the bottom of the pile, that thing, it spoke so much to the working class English, young English that we were. But when we went out with a mission to change it, no, we went out with our ideas and spiritual ideas, political ideas, and we made statements hoping that it would do something. I mean, like when you listen to Tommy, for instance, we got lucky with that, that it was an idea of what it would be like to go through life just feeling vibrations, like the main character being not being able to talk, not being able to hear, not being able to see. But what it did, it resonated with the Vietnam War. It resonated with them in a way that they felt that they weren't being seen, heard, and had no voice. And it became it became part of a movement. But it wasn't intentional at the time. It was just a series of events. I think the way the band, obviously we moved on, we won't get forward again and things like that, which which are kind of apolitical. They're not, you know, it's neither for the left or for the right. It's just about, we always end up in the same boat, you know. Meet the new boss, he's the same as the old boss. And all through my life, I'm afraid to say that's what usually happens. But we haven't done a bad job. The main thing I'm proud of, if I have to be proud of anything, and I don't really like proud, but I am really, really pleased that it was always our dream that music didn't have just to be for teenagers of our age. We've been making this music, all our audiences were all teenagers up to their, you know, to 25. That was our age group. But now our audience is from 80 to 8. And that I'm really happy about, because that means that music is getting through. And the words that you are singing and the Who songs, have, you know, if Pete Townshend writes those songs, I connect them with the audience, but that's a gift we were given. He had this way of writing, a very, very internal feelings, and I had the gift of communicating it to the listener. And it works.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
When you get an audience of the old grandparents bringing their grandchildren, it's the most wonderful feeling you could ever have. It really is. It's like, yeah, this music has meant something more than just the face value of it. The initiation of it was just commercialization. How do we make a product to sell? But it's worked. Just not knock it.
But no, it matters a lot, I think, even in charity, that we connect with people. And so, Roger, I think it's been really helpful to your charity that you have this ability to connect with people. In all charitable organizations, what we hope is that our cause can resonate with people so that they donate, so that they participate, so that they volunteer. And the gift of celebrity certainly helps, but who the celebrity is also matters. And what that individual is willing to commit, both personally and with others, to that charitable enterprise makes a big difference. And I'm just interested in knowing, Roger, how have you personally committed? I know you said you visited hospitals, you've thought about different ways to get your mission out there. And, you know, you've been on the road a lot, you've been traveling. How have you been able to find time to do all this?
There's always time. Charity, when you're committed to it, we do it very differently in England than you do in America. Like, if the Who do a charity event for an organization, and we've got a couple planned for the next tour we do it unconditionally. And as long as the expenses are paid, there is no charge. In America, artists get paid to do charities, which I find a little bit of an anathema. It kind of sits a bit weird, because the way we do it in England, it's just unconditional. If you recognize that it's something that needs to be done, you give yourself, you give of yourself. That's more valuable than any kind of financial donation you can make, in a way. That's what the artist, that's their power. They've got their power to give that gift, and it's more valuable than dollars or pounds or yen or whatever. And so it has to be unconditional. It is a bit puzzling to me that not all Americans are like that. We have found the ones that are willing to come and play and not get paid. You know, Eddie Vedder, Dave Grohl, Pink, Van Morrison, there's loads of people that are quite willing to step up and say, we support this, and here we are making our mark with it. And the more things can change like that, the better off charities will be. But you do, you know, this is where your organisation, the Better Business Bureau, is incredibly important, because you recognise foundations have to be well run. They can't be just there for the CEO to have a nice car or a load of plane trips for free. It doesn't work like that. You know, charity should be about the money that's going to the front line doing the job. Very simply, I don't really know much about the way your charity laws work, but ours in England are very, very strict. Very, very strict. And we've carried that on in Teen Cancer America, thanks to my partner, Rebecca Rothstein, and indeed the guy who runs the caboodle over there, from England, Simon Davis. I mean, our team is remarkable. What they've achieved in 8 years from absolutely nothing, we're in like 43 or nearly 45 hospitals. If it hadn't have been for the pandemic, that number would have been 60. But of course, the pandemic has hit our fundraising really, really hard because it was all based on events. And as you know, events have been cancelled.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll get back to that soon. But you mentioned how important it is to have an organization that's run well. And your organization, Teen Cancer, has gone through our process and has been evaluated. You're accredited. You meet all of our standards. And it's just great because, you know, there are many celebrity organizations that don't go through that process, that don't necessarily take the time and focus to make sure that they are doing all of the things that you need to do to manage a charity well. So there's a big, I would say, heart that many of these folk have, but they don't necessarily manage it to the extent that it could be managed. So that you're doing that says a lot about you personally and what you think is important for the public to know about the work that you're doing. So I just want to commend you for going through that process and coming out, meeting all of the standards. It's a really great accomplishment. And thanks for mentioning it also.
I have to say that I was always aware. I knocked on doors for 11 years before I got a foot in the door at UCLA with the head of the hospital called David Feinberg. Wonderful man. I was doing a charity event for the autistic program at UCLA. Completely unrelated to what became Teen Cancer America, but I got to sit down with him for an hour and tell him about my idea for bringing Teen Cancer America into reality. And he listened to the idea. He loved the idea. He said, I'm going to send a team to England to see what you're doing, and I'm going to get them to report back to me. And sure enough, within 3 months, he'd lived up to that word. A team came over, they saw what we were doing in London. They went back and they reported to David that we had the gold standard and they were missing the trick. We've got to be on this page. They're way ahead of us. And this is simple. This is all to do with a little bit of change of management, goodwill from the management of the hospitals, goodwill from the medical staff, and recognition from the public that this issue will solve a lot of bigger problems in society in the long term. I'm sure of it. So anyway, within a year, we had our first unit at UCLA. That was in 2012. And now we've got 42 hospitals. I mean, we've got a queue of 60 hospitals wanting to partnership with us in getting these programs set up. But of course, we can only do it with donations from the American public. And I'm not American. I'm English. I'm British. And I knew right from the outset that I would never be part of the running of this thing. But what I could be part of was the setting up of it. And in my partner, Rebecca Rothstein, I found someone. She is so sharp with the finances. In our CEO, or I don't know what we called him. I'm not very good at all that stuff. But Simon Davis, the guy who actually runs the front line of the charity, he ran the Teenage Cancer Trust in England, and he took us from 6 hospital wards to 28 in 15 years. And I managed to headhunt him to come to America. But I'm knowing all the time that I wouldn't be able to have any influence at all on how this is run, only my wish that this is 100% for the people we say it is for. And that is for adolescents and young adults on the front line. And that's what it's turned out to be. And I'm so proud of those guys. They've done such a great job on what some of the most difficult times we've had since the Second World War. You can't make it up. I mean, it's a dream come true for me. Because, and being part of your, you know, being recognized by you for me, because I've been very worried through the pandemic of our fundraising and our commitment to hospitals not being able to be met financially, that Teen Cancer America would kind of disappear into the mist. I've been concerned about that. But I feel that hopefully, now that you've recognized us for what we do, it's cemented in stone in your country. These are your teenagers and young adults. Be there for them. They deserve it.
Well, Roger, we're getting to the end of this. I want to know from you what you feel is one of your best accomplishments. What makes you feel most proud about what you've done through your music to create good in the world and also outside of your music? What makes you most proud? And what would you say to people who are thinking about engaging in some type of charitable opportunity? What do you think they should expect to get out of it if they invest in it themselves?
I think I'd have to say the thing I'm most proud of is my family, because they are really good people, and people are everything to me. And the second thing would have to be I'm most proud of Teenage Cancer Trust and Teen Cancer America. And all I can tell you is, all right, you can go out and earn a lot of money and you can gain a lot of stuff. You soon very quickly get fed up with the Ferraris. You only need one car. You know, it's all just stuff that clutters up your life in the end. But the reward you get from making someone else's life a little bit better, you can't put price on that. It's priceless. It's priceless. And if only we could just teach ourselves to rein ourselves in a bit and be a little kinder to each other. You know, we need people pulling people together now, not pushing people apart. The divisions are too great now. Come on, guys. The one thing I've never, ever, ever got from any of our patients, any of the teenagers I've met, I've never met one of them that feels sorry for themselves, that are down in the mouth. Yeah, they feel ill. They are, their spirits are always, yeah, we'll get through this. They're always so solid. They are truly, truly inspiring. They really are.
Roger, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us on the Heart of Giving podcast. And wow, I mean, what a great career and great life you've had. And you're still vital, obviously, with teen cancer and making sure that young people have a place to go when they're in this time of need, in this moment of need. You've been very prescient in how you've thought through this. You've obviously prepared yourself to be vital and to be meaningful in this regard. And so you're, I think, an example for what others in your position — there aren't that many in your position, but there are lots of successful artists out there. I hope that some of them will take a bite out of what you've done to create ways to, you know, help other people who are struggling in different ways. I hope they'll take a look at what you've done. You've created a blueprint for people who've achieved fame and fortune through art and other means, and you've demonstrated how they can give back and add to the meaningfulness of their lives. So I just want to commend you, thank you, and wish you continued success in all that you're doing, my friend.
Thank you. That's kind of you. It really is. And I wish you all the best of health this year. It'll be all over my next year, don't worry. Let's get people together. Let's start smiling again.
Let's start smiling.
Let's start hugging each other.
Well, next time I'm in the UK, I'm going to look you up, my friend, and buy you a cup of coffee.
Yeah, you come have a beer on the farm.
All right, I will do that. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.